is that there are more people with obsessive compulsive disorder than we thought. There are many people, both adolescents and adults, probably also children, who suffer with obsessive compulsive disorder and, for the most part, manage to keep that a secret. Perhaps as many as 4 million people, both adults and children, have obsessive compulsive disorder. We are coming to understand it a little bit better, and some kinds of therapy, both behavior therapy and drug therapy, have helped some people. We'll talk about obsessive compulsive disorder, what it is, and some of the treatments this morning with Dr. Rappaport. And as we talk, we welcome your questions and your comments if you'd like to call in. Here in Champaign-Urbana, it's 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, which is good anywhere that you hear the station, and that is 800-222-9455. I also would like to mention that E.P. Dutton is the publisher of the book. And here say good morning to Dr. Rappaport.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for giving us some of your time.
A pleasure.
I think that we can help people understand by giving some examples, especially to understand the difference between what we might call everyday kind of compulsive behavior and obsessive compulsive disorder. Maybe it would be useful to go right to an example. And why don't you tell us about Dr. S., this the man that you profile very early in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, he certainly is one good example. He is a checker, and he had obsessive doubts about whether or not he had hit someone when driving his car. And Dr. S., who is a research psychologist and author in his own right, a book on stress in the workplace, is a very sane man and otherwise very reasonable. But when his obsessions hit, when his obsessive compulsive disorder used to be severe, he would stand up to 2-3 hours at a time driving back and forth along the same route he had traveled, checking for a body which he thought maybe he could have hit. Let me get it really clear. This man is really rational. He himself could tell me that there had been no other cars or even pedestrians along the highway. But when he got into the checking routine, there went his day. And he would be very upset as he did this because he'd be missing important appointments. Dr. S. has appeared on the Donahue show to describe this himself and impressed everybody by his otherwise reasonableness. He got a lot of help, as we can talk about later, with a number of treatments, and now is very proud that he can help other people.
Yeah. One of the things that makes it a little bit difficult to read the accounts in the book, I think your heart really goes out to these people, because you can tell that clearly they are tormented by their bizarre behaviors. And what really makes it difficult, I think, is that they understand that they're captives of their behavior. They know in part of their mind somewhere, they know that it doesn't make sense for them to be doing what they're doing. And at the same time, they can't stop.
Absolutely. I liken this in the book to a hiccup of the mind, because it's at such a distance from most of the patients with obsessions and compulsions. They come to you and say, do you really have something that I can do or to take that will make me stop this? And it's very much like a person with a hiccups. When the hiccups go away, no one says, did you need to make this strange noise? They just say, thank God that's over. Well, it's the same with these patients. A woman I know who had her first big break, a terrific job as a commercial artist. She'd been a struggling artist, and this was a chance to make a lot of money, very excited about the job. And she had a version of checking that she would have to see whether her door was locked. And she would turn the handle and then start to go down her steps to her car, and then she'd have to go back and check once more. So far, like anybody, right? Mm-hmm. But 2 hours later, she's still there. And it was heartbreaking that she nearly lost this job. She finally was able to get treatment and go back, and actually they hired her again. But that she was absolutely desperate. How can I get out of this, she'd ask.
When you talk about one kind of group of people that you find when you look at obsessive compulsive disorder, and you have given one example, and that is the checker, the people who continue to have to, who just, like the example with the woman who had to keep going back to check if the door is locked, somehow they can't they can't persuade themselves that they've done that action and have to keep going back and checking. There is another, apparently, and the most common kind of behavior, and you've titled your book for it, is washing, things that have to do either with a person washing themselves or with, it can be their apartment or their home, for example, that they continue to have to keep cleaning. Tell us about, here's another person you write about in your book. A young man, his name is Zach. When you talked to him, he was 9, and he is a washer, and that he says when he was 6, he began to have this fear of getting his hands dirty, and by the time he was 7, he was washing his hands 35 times a day.
Oh, at least we have seen patients when they're in a washing phase, or for whom washing's the worst problem, who wash their hands 200 times a day. One child would scrub his hands with Mr. Clean, and in the extreme cases, the hands can look red and raw as if they have a skin disease. People who shower can be stuck in showers for a day at a time. And again, at first you think that's crazy or that's humorous, but when you talk to the person, they're absolutely miserable about it. Zach, the boy you mentioned, had the feeling out of the blue that his hands couldn't feel clean enough. And he had had some other compulsive rituals before, odd ones like having to swallow a certain number of times and being very concerned that he might touch something dirty. But once the hand washing began, he, like a number of other children, took this to extremes. When he would finish washing his hands, he would have to turn the faucets off with his elbows. In the rare cases when we've had to admit people in our study for who have washing problems to our hospital at the National Institute of Health, the nurses had to ration bars of soap a day.
And another thing that's fascinating about this particular kind of people is that it doesn't necessarily correlate with neatness. That is, I remember one story about, and I think it's in that same passage where you talk about the fact that they had to ration the soap. When some of these people were in hospitals, that the nurses, like their parents might have had to, were constantly nagging them about picking up their clothes and keeping their room neat. So it's odd that it should be such a specially targeted thing. They were, you know, that it should affect part of their behavior and part of themselves, and then something else that seemed to be logically related, it wouldn't have anything to do with.
Exactly. We are all learning that now, that the so-called compulsive personality, people who are very rigid and may be extremely neat and controlling in a number of ways, are often likely to get depressed in the long run. These are people who often alienate their employees and their spouses and children because everything has to be done just so. They're perfectionists, the sort of person who can never keep a secretary, that no one can live with them because they're always getting the house out of order, according to the person with the compulsive personality. Those people are likely to get depressed a great deal because the people close to them, in fact, abandon them. But that's not the same thing as obsessive-compulsive disorder, and in fact, that very specificity to certain things to do with grooming and danger and doorways and certain sorts of thoughts led us to have a whole other theory about obsessive-compulsive disorder, that it's quite separate from the personality and everyday neatness.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that's sort of intriguing that you talk about in the book is the fact that when one person with obsessive-compulsive disorder meets another, if they have similar sorts of disorders, that if for example they're both washers, they can be fairly sympathetic with one another, and yet if a washer meets a checker, somehow they think the other person is kind of odd. They don't seem to have that same kind of sympathy for them that they would for someone who has the similar kind of behavior that is similar to theirs.
Right. Well, the patients themselves are now getting much more educated about their disorder through a really phenomenal group that has been developed called the OCD Foundation, based in New Haven, Connecticut. And that has helped the patients recognize and support each other. But something else that would have to qualify my own statement in the book, and that is, as we followed patients now for 15 or 18 years, we find that symptoms for many of them come in blocks of 4 or 5 years. So that one boy I'm thinking of for grade school years, he had to count. He had to do everything in numbers of 6 or 17 times, which took up a lot of his time and presented one sort of problem. In high school, he was a more typical patient with a lot of washing and showering for hours in the shower. And as an adult, he became overly scrupulous and would spend hours on end as a young adult worrying about whether he had done something inappropriate and hurt somebody in some way, or never really true. So that someone like that would understand people who were in the other phases.
Well, this morning, let me remind people who may just have tuned in, we're talking with Dr. Judith Rappaport, the author of the book, The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Washing. It's about the experience and treatment of obsessive-compulsive disorder. If you have questions for us, you can call in here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free anywhere you hear the station, Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that comes out in your book is also the fact that obsessive-compulsive disorder seems to run in families. We talked about Dr. S., who had a son who also had obsessive-compulsive disorder, and then we talked about Zach. His father has had the obsessive-compulsive disorder. That would seem to suggest that this is a trait that is genetically inherited.
Very convinced that it's genetic for almost a quarter of our patients. At the National Institute of Health for the last 10 years, we've been doing interviews for the people in our study on every single member of the immediate family. By that I mean brother, sister, mother, father, or children, just the immediate family. And in the large series that we've now looked at, 25% of our patients have somebody else in the immediate family with obsessive-compulsive disorder. Now, of course, someone can say, well, does that mean it's genetic? What if they're just copying someone else in the family? But we have a good answer to that, and that is that most of the time, the other family member has a different symptom. For example, in our study right now are identical twins who have obsessive-compulsive disorder. They've benefited a lot from some of the new treatments, but one of them washes for hours every day, and the other one prays for hours every day over sins that he, in fact, knows aren't real. For example, he may have, he thinks, made noises in class, disturbing his class, but no one else, including the teacher, heard any noises.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them, we are sure, have obsessive-compulsive disorder, and we don't think there's any way that one would have copied their problems from the other.
Apparently, one of the things that you write about is the fact that for a long time, while obsessive-compulsive disorder was known to exist, it was recognized and studied, it was thought to be relatively rare, and that now we're coming to understand that there are more people with obsessive-compulsive disorder than we had thought, and that the reason we at one time thought it was rare is that to a large extent, these people are pretty good at managing to keep it hidden and living their lives as best they can, even though they suffer with the obsessive-compulsive disorder. The thing that I wonder is that some of the behaviors that are described they're noticeable. I mean, I don't know how someone, especially someone who was close to this person, could not notice. And I wonder, how is it that these people manage to conceal their obsessive-compulsive disorder so successfully, apparently in some cases for many years?
That's a good question, and I think that it's not as successful in one sense as it may seem. Many of our patients have either divorced or never married, and it's not because they didn't have the opportunity, but because if you spend 2 or 3 hours a night either checking or washing or with one variant of obsessive-compulsive disorder in which you're compelled to pull your own hair out, if you do these things, even if you're very upset you're doing them, you're still doing them. And they have been very concerned that anyone who lived with them wouldn't understand and would think this was a terrible waste of time, which it is. So in that sense, it's not successful, and there's a lot of suffering. But there is a partial voluntary control over these symptoms, so that someone who, for example, keeps very busy during the day, I have patients who are bank executives, who are successful writers on magazines, who do all sorts of high-powered jobs, some of them are able to get through their day and then spend their evenings and their free time doing the rituals.
Hmm. It's really fascinating. One thing that I thought about as I was reading, especially the account of Dr. S's child and some of the behaviors of that child, that it seemed that some of the behaviors that you might see in a child with obsessive compulsive disorder seem to me similar to those that you might see in a child that was diagnosed as having attention deficit disorder, what we used to call hyperactive. And I wonder, and I may be misunderstanding on my part, but I wonder whether there might be some kids who are diagnosed as attention deficit disorder who are actually obsessive compulsive.
Right. Now, you're very sharp as far as the particular case goes. That was Dr. S's son. I think he had two diagnoses, and one was attention deficit disorder, and the other was obsessive compulsive disorder. And that's the final impression of his own treating doctors, too.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the patients with obsessive compulsive disorder aren't particularly likely to have other disorders, although they can. I've seen obsessive compulsive disorder in some juvenile delinquents, for example, and they clearly had two kinds of problems, whatever was causing the delinquency, the conduct problem, and the obsessions and compulsions. But number of other conditions are varied that can go along with obsessive compulsive disorder. Depression is another common one, and we think that's often secondary. That is, if your life is being wasted hours every day, that is a depressing fact.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I'm still thinking of your question on the fact that it's hidden, and I think we're really realizing how well people have been concealing this because of the National Institute of Mental Health survey that suggested that more than 2% of people in this country have the disorder. And that really makes it possible that there are 5 million or more people in this country that have obsessive-compulsive disorder. And that's a remarkable statistic, considering that that brings it up into the ballpark of alcoholism, of the depressions and the phobias. And when you think how many books and how much has been written on these other subjects,
mm-hmm.
and here you have a disorder of comparable frequency that no one has ever heard of.
Hmm. Well, and I suppose that again, though, goes back to the success that many obsessive people with the OCD have had in managing to keep it pretty much under wraps.
Exactly, and there are a number of different ways they can hide this. One rather attractive woman who is a successful bond salesman and no slouch, but she has managed, because of her cleaning rituals and a peculiar compulsion she has, to make sure that her eyebrows are symmetrical,
mm-hmm.
and so she has a tweezers and will rush off to the ladies' room secretly in a panic about a lack of symmetry in her eyebrows, which are over-plucked because if she keeps on neatening up one side and then she has to do the other. But she says that at work, her colleagues think of her as a kind of airhead, a Southern Belle type, because she'll kind of bat her eyes and say she just has to go and fix her makeup. And in fact, she's really desperate and very unhappy.
Hmm.
Other people just become rather isolated and aloof, and people think they're either snobbish or wonder about their private lives, why they never married, and so on, because they need to do this. One man, again, a successful employee of a bank, rising in his bank's hierarchy, spends more than an hour and a half every night checking his fence in his backyard. He has a white fence that goes around a sort of sizable backyard to see if there are any loose boards. There's no reason for it. His doors are locked, and it wouldn't matter if there were boards down. but it's a compulsion he has, and people just think of him as an unsociable guy.
Yeah. Well, I have a caller here, and I hope that we may have some other folks who have questions for us. We'll go to the toll-free line and talk with this person right here. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to share something about myself, and I'd like to say that I find in it reason for some of the compulsions that I have myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to say that I disagree with the fact that people in the family can develop different compulsions and yet not have them be from the same cause. And I'll give you my example. For years, I won't go into detail on anything, but one in particular, I have, for years, I had, after leaving home, which was quite early, from a very physically abusive and crazy mother, I had very, very humongous amounts of compulsions. And I spent many years, that's my son for the first time in a month, he's washing the dishes.
Right.
But, let's see, I had, how will I put it? I had extreme amounts of problems, and they would go in cycles. I would be hospitalized for different periods, and then...
What kind of compulsion?
I had, let's see, one of them was pulling out my hair, for instance.
Uh-huh.
And that's the one I'm going to use as my example.
Uh-huh.
But
I
would stand for hours pulling out my hair.
Mm-hmm.
And I would stand in front of a mirror for hours doing this to the point where I couldn't get off to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't do anything. I couldn't dress or anything. And I had a lot of different ones. I had muscle twitches and eye tics and muscle spasms, you know, that I felt I had done myself. You know, I had tightened my muscles and loosened them.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, they got to be more or less automatic. But some of the other things, were more serious, and I really don't want to go into them, but I had a total loss of mind. I lost my mind, and I wasn't able to function, and I was in terrible distress and pain,
mm-hmm.
and there wasn't any drug or any help for me from anyone, and none of the hospitalizations. But I'd like to say that after years, I did face some of the things I had locked away in my memory, not the things that the abuses that my mother had done to me, mostly to my head, the area of my head. She had battered my head many times for hours at a time, every day of my childhood, and I knew I remembered that, and also family members remembered that very distinctly because I was in court over it and. She tried to have me locked up, and they had taken me away from her. And it wasn't that I didn't remember. I didn't remember the seriousness of the pain, and I didn't remember that I had tried to hide from the pain by hiding behind some compulsive behaviors, one of which was the pulling of the hair. And during the process of my life, my adult life, my successful adult life, I have found that some of these little things shake free, and one of them I'd like to share with you was when I was pulling my hair, which I still do. I still do this behavior. I found that I remembered I had a very vivid memory. I do a lot of work with this on my own and also with other people. But one of the things that shook free was the feeling of pulling this hair. And I felt the pain of my self-inflicted pain of pulling it. And then I had a memory. I remembered when I was a little child, my mother had pulled my hair very terribly. She used to lift me up by my hair and swing me around and throw me into corners of the room. And one of the times I pulled my hair, at that time I just said, I pulled it and I remembered the pain. And I remembered pulling my hair myself as a child. Because of a particularly painful spot in my head where my mother had battered me with a very heavy object. And I pulled the hair, and the more I pulled as a child, the more the pain stopped, because it covered the pain of the battering, and I was able to make some of that pain, I was able to gain some control over that pain as a tiny child of five.
I think you've really had a very courageous act by calling and sharing that with people, and I thank you very much.
It's very difficult for me to do that. I just want to end with saying that that I didn't remember that for years and years, and I'm not saying I have any better control over it now that I know some of the reasons behind my problems, but I do feel that a lot of people in families, my sister has developed some very not serious problems, but she's developed some compulsions. She didn't have anything as hard as I did. But everybody develops different ways of hiding their pain and hiding the problems that the world around them has dealt them. And I feel that even if someone in a family develops a different kind, we're all individuals. And Kai?
Yeah.
Okay, and I'd like to say I find this a very interesting program. I just feel very strongly that there are reasons for everything that a child does. And there are important reasons. We just may not know them until we figure out who we are and what has happened to us and how we chose to deal with them. And that it stays the same as we grow up. We do choose the same kinds of things, and they're different from our sisters and brothers. And thank you very much.
Okay. Bye. I appreciate the call. I wonder, Dr. Rappaport, what you think about that story, and especially, you know, one of the things I wanted to have you talk about was treatment
of
obsessive compulsive disorder.
Well,
and
sure. The woman who called in done a very courageous thing of sharing her personal experience, and it's important in a number of things. First of all, it's clear that she's gotten a great deal of support from therapy, which is very helpful when you've had a life of abuse and a life of care from people in your childhood that you in some ways couldn't trust in very basic ways. And psychotherapy for those kinds of problems is very, very helpful. But the great majority of the hundreds of patients we've seen with the hair pulling and the other compulsions have had very unremarkable childhoods. People come to us after years and years of psychotherapy, which helped them learn to trust people, which helped them with depression and anxiety, but like the woman who just phoned in, tend not to stop the hair pulling and the hand washing. And the psychotherapy, in which I believe, can do remarkable things for people, particularly for depression. But for people who need to get control over these particular symptoms, and particularly the great, great majority of people with the hair pulling and the hand washing, whose family lives were really unremarkable, even after years of therapy of trying to find out what hint, what unconscious problems they have. If you just want to get rid of the symptoms, the two most important therapies are behavior therapy and several different newer medications that have been developed. But I want it to be very, very clear that this is not an anti-psychotherapy statement. But what we're learning in psychiatry is that you need all kinds of treatments and that different treatments are best for different goals. We have women who have had years of analysis which helped them in many ways, in profound ways, with relationships with others, but they were still bald from pulling out their hair. If they wanted to stop wearing wigs, the most useful thing were some of these new medicines. We have other people who years of psychotherapy did, as I say, help them understand how to control their relationships, how to trust people. And some people found it useful even if they weren't like the majority of our patients whose family lives weren't in any way difficult.
Mm-hmm. We're talking this morning with Dr. Judith Rappaport. She is an authority on obsessive compulsive disorder, and she is the author of the recently published book, The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Washing. Our guest this morning is Dr. Judith Rappaport. She is a child psychiatrist. In fact, she is chief of the child psychiatry branch at the National Institute of Mental Health and is an authority on obsessive-compulsive disorder. That's what we're talking about here this morning. If you have questions, we have a couple of local lines open. 333-9455 is the number. Before going on to some other callers, I just would like to have you talk a little bit more about treatment. For some people who have obsessive-compulsive disorder, they have been helped by using some antidepressant medications.
Well, new antidepressant medications, and there's two kinds of treatments that are the most effective and that have been proven to be effective. as we were talking before, psychotherapy has been good for many other things, but hasn't been particularly effective for the symptoms of obsessive compulsive disorder. And one of the reasons why I wrote this book was in order that the millions of people with OCD would be aware not only how much company they have of other people suffering secretly, but that there's great new hope in these newer treatments. And I'd rather mention the non-drug treatment first, because if someone can do something without a drug, that's how they should go.
Mm-hmm.
Behavior therapy is a form of therapy that's designed to stop particular symptoms. It's not meant to be a replacement for psychotherapy, but for some people it is clearly the most direct and most effective route. An example of behavior therapy is take someone who compulsively washes their hands 100 times a day. And I picked this example for a particular reason, because behavior therapy is much better when you have compulsions, that is, the need to do rituals, than with obsessions that are more just thoughts in your head. And a behavior therapist would work with this hand washer and find out, let's say, that touching anything triggers the washing. They'd first get a very careful listing of symptoms. Let's say if they shake with hands with someone, turn a doorknob, etc., they have to go and wash. What a behavior therapist would do would be, over a period of usually several months, work carefully with this person in exposing them to the thing that sets off these washing rituals, such as shaking hands or touching doorknobs, and then work with them to deliberately not wash. Their own jargon would be exposure with response prevention. And by the end of behavior therapy, you might be doing really some overkill approaches. For example, one woman in a Philadelphia center, by the end of her treatment, who had been a washer, was paying the great people on the streets of Philadelphia 50 cents to shake hands with her as part of her very final lesson, so to speak.
Hmm.
For the people who either can't or won't respond to behavior therapy, those are people who feel they couldn't go through with such a program, or people with a lot of obsessions that are much less amenable to that treatment. There's two or three newer drugs, and this is where you have to be really careful, because these new drugs all happen to be antidepressants.
Mm-hmm.
They're perfectly good antidepressants, but I'm not sure they're anything special. But most antidepressants don't do anything for obsessive or compulsive disorder. And so it's really important that someone know that it can't be just any antidepressant. There's one that's not yet on the market called clomipramine that doctors can get through the drug's manufacturer. There's another one called fluoxetine, which has come on the market as an antidepressant, and the company is applying for a license to use this in obsessions and compulsions. There's another one still in a research phase that is will be applying to come on the market in this country. And all three of these look very, very promising for the treatment of obsessions and compulsions.
Very good. Well, we have some callers here waiting, and let's talk with them. Line one, our next person. Hello.
Hello, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question for the doctor.
Yes.
A question. How do you go about in approaching or even suggesting to this person that you have this disorder?
You mean when it's someone close to you?
Yes, very close. It happens to be, this person happens to be my mother-in-law.
Right.
And
well,
she has this fetish about always being clean, which mm-hmm. is fine to a certain extent, but she's just, it's like a ritual. Even if it's clean, she still has to clean it over and over and over again.
Sure. A lot of people there's a number of answers I'd have to that. First, and this is an author with a new book, so you have to realize that, a number of people have written me saying that giving the book, The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Washing, to their husband or their sister, or in one case their boss, seemed to have been very helpful. But you have to know the person, and it depends on what your relationship is. As a physician, I've learned that there are often a lot of clues a person gives me to tell me what I can tell them. You know, the patient that says, what's the good news, is asking for one message, where someone else who says, tell it to me straight, is asking for another.
Okay.
So you have to use, of course, your instincts with this. But I think you might say, well, I heard this radio program, for example.
Right. And I seen your show on Donahue, and there was one lady there that I think had this also.
I think the main thing is that another thing is the OCD Foundation is starting support groups mm-hmm. for people with the disorder and, just as important, for families of right. people with the disorder.
Well, what I was thinking about doing is, you know, I haven't bought the book yet, but I was going to this week and just take it with me when we see her this month mm-hmm. and just, you know, either just giving it to her mm-hmm. and, you know, just don't be so blunt about it, but just try to express my feelings about her and what I think is going on.
Mm-hmm. You, if some people, many people with obsessive compulsive disorder just really do acknowledge it and say, I just can't help it, I can't stop. And it's been their own fear that they couldn't do anything about it that makes them not want to talk about it. But in other cases, it could be that a person is just very defensive, and then you have to be careful or right. you can make things worse.
That's right. Okay, well, thank you so much for your information.
All right.
Good
thank
luck.
You for the call. Thanks. Someone else here holding on our line number two. Hello.
Yes, doctor. I do want to thank you for the book because it's been very helpful in our case, but I was calling to see if you happen to have the number for the Obsessive Compulsive Disorder Foundation, a phone number that we could call.
Right. I'm trying to see if I have it. I don't have the foundation number. I just have their address.
Okay.
The Post Office Box 9573 in New Haven, Connecticut, and it's 06535 is the zip code. And I've been told by people that the foundation gets back very promptly with newsletters and application forms and things like that, and they are very, very good at putting people in touch with the right people or facilities, whatever part of the country they're in.
Okay, well, we sure appreciate your help, Doctor.
You're very welcome.
All right. Thank you for the call. About 10 minutes left. Again, our guest is Dr. Judith Rappaport. We're talking about obsessive compulsive disorder, and she's the author of the book, The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Washing. I wonder, Dr. Rappaport, as you think about obsessive compulsive disorder, whether you feel that it is somehow an extension of what we might call garden variety obsession, or whether somehow there it's not a continuum, and at some point there's a break and obsessive compulsive disorder just kind of jumps off the scale, and maybe in fact it's something different and it's not related to less problematic behaviors that maybe almost everybody has.
We think it really is something different. We have followed up people with these so-called normal everyday behaviors, even very strong ones, and they don't seem to turn into obsessive-compulsive disorder at all. And we think that there's a much more profound meaning in the pattern of these symptoms, that we think in an evolutionary way that many of these are behaviors that at a very primitive level are hardwired into the brain. We think that the hair pulling and maybe severe nail biting and the washing can be grooming behaviors run wild that in an evolutionary sense could have been very adaptive at some time in our development. And there's a number of studies, several of them our own, that show that there's a particular system in the brain, an old system of the brain called the basal ganglia, in which something is being sparked off, so to speak, in obsessive compulsive disorder. And we have taken the lesson from the ethologists. Ethology is the study of animal behaviors, particularly animal behaviors that seem to have a big inherited component. And we now have an animal model for obsessive compulsive disorder, in which these new drugs help specifically with some of these animal grooming behaviors run wild.
Hmm.
We have studies going on with very, very severe nail biters. I mean the kind whose hands look like they've been in an accident, whose fingers are bleeding, and of the most severe form. These new anti-obsessional drugs work for that, too. We have brain imaging studies that show that part of the frontal lobe and part of the basal ganglia are lit up in these patients with obsessive compulsive disorder and not in the normal controls and not in other psychiatric conditions in the same way. And when we put all of this enormous amount of different information together, it points to a very biological system that somehow gets triggered off. But we see these as really ethological, that is, related often to animal type of behaviors, conditions that are just running wild in OCD.
So perhaps to think about it and to make a computer analogy, it's as if there was some program mm-hmm. that would lead to a certain kind of behavior that at one time would have been productive. There would have been good reasons for it, and that it's something that perhaps a long time ago we stopped needing, and yet the program was still buried there somewhere, and that in some people something is happening to start the program running, and it's just running out of control.
That's exactly it. I'm not the first to think of this, although I'm the first to be pushing it for obsessions and compulsions, but people studying phobias for many years have commented on the fact that if it was rational, people would be phobic about highways and guns. But instead, look what phobias focus on: insects, snakes, and being trapped in small spaces. And those are more relevant to ancient enemies of man over evolutionary time and have nothing to do with the biggest real dangers.
Let's take another caller. We have someone on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi, it's me again. I just would like to clarify something that I didn't make clear on my first call.
Mm-hmm.
The help that I received in with all the problems that I had, was the only real help that I received was the help that I got from people, from regular human beings who had were able to share with me their own feelings. And most of what I heard from all these people that were able to help me was that there was nothing wrong or strange about me, and that everybody had some things that they didn't like to share or that were personal to them and they didn't really like, especially about themselves, or they found compulsive, or, you know, and everybody shared some things, and people were able to make me see that it wasn't only me. Now, this may not work for everybody, but one thing I'd like to say else is that when I did some community work with in a mental hospital in Elgin, Illinois, I did work with, I was community, and there was staff, and there were patients of the hospital working together for a new kind of program where everyone, and I got money, my stipend came directly from the government. We were working on a huge grant with Dr. Norma Jean Orlando. And one of the experiments that she did was she took an old idea and she made it into the mental hospital mode. She took the patients in the hospital and she switched roles with them, with the staff. And she put the staff behind the bars and the patients outside. And they were fed regularly and treated like the patients were treated. And they found that after a week or two of this, that the staff was had the same reactions that the patients had had. They had developed the same kinds of symptoms, the walking symptoms, the hair pulling, the nail biting, the walking, the holding on, that lost look, and the feeling that they had lost their minds. And each one of them described vividly, and she did this as a study. She has published it, and she showed, she had it on television. She showed that really a lot of times, and I'm not disputing the biological, but I'm just saying that a lot of times the way we react and the way we're treated reflects what the symptoms that we show. And I think that that's one thing that shows this. And the other thing is, in the body will, I think, come along if you do treat your body to a certain compulsive behavior over and over. I believe that it does make certain chemicals more prevalent in your body, and so I think you can read it both ways when you read some biological things. A better way to hold some of those experiments is to look at the person before they become what they will become and see if you do find the physical things and if they do pan out in the end. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Some reaction, Dr. Rappaport?
Very well put. We do have some prospective studies with children with OCD and have very good records from their schools and parents as children. And we've been trying very hard to see if there are any predictors for this. Most of the children we studied, I think, seemed absolutely normal within their families and themselves before they became ill. going back, but we've also done some epidemiological studies. I have other people to see if there's anything unusual in the families and so on in whole populations. But I think it's very eloquently put, the caller, that's addressing some, I think, not directly related issues, but how important the general attitude and participation in very important psychotherapies and very interesting research going on that sounds like it's awfully good work and very eloquently described. I don't, it's not directly relevant, but it sounds like awfully good stuff she's describing.
Well, let me ask you. I think that you say in the book that something like half of the adult obsessive compulsives say that, or maybe it's your feeling that half of them began to develop their symptoms when they were children.
Oh, absolutely. That's true in everybody's experience.
It is. So does it help, that is, is treatment more productive if you can intervene when the person is a child, or when you're working with adults, is it about as effective?
We're trying to look at that right now and trying to get the answer. It certainly seemed to us logically that if half of these 6 million people started in childhood, that it would make very good sense to start treating people when they're children, because the effect on relationships in the family can be devastating. Brothers and sisters very much resent the attention these children receive, and the isolation in adolescence is terrible for their personal and social development. But we don't have the data to answer that question yet.
Well, we will have to leave it at that. I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Very, very interesting topic. I appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Thank you.
And also, I will recommend, if there are people who are listening who would like to read more about this, about obsessive compulsive disorder, you can look for the book that we've been talking about. The title is The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Washing. It's published by E.P. Dutton, by our guest Judith Rappaport. She is chief of the child psychiatry branch of the National Institute of Mental Health.